Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Sheila O'Flanagan.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Welcome
very much.
To the show. We are bringing you in to chat you through some of your favourite songs. You grew up in Walkinstown in Dublin, mm-hmm. and your first musical influence was your dad, who... Was he self-taught or was he yeah. a professional? He wasn't a professional musician.
Oh gosh, no, he wasn't. But he loved music and he was self-taught. He played the accordion. So he learned on the accordion or taught himself on the accordion and then bought a piano and taught himself on the piano. So he used to, on Sunday mornings, which was his kind of downtime, he used to go into our front room, you know, the good room.
Yeah, that the good room.
And he'd sit there and he'd play a whole selection of things and stuff that he'd have heard on the radio or whatever. And he'd just sit down and play away. And sometimes he'd come in and sit and listen to him. And sometimes we'd just leave him to it. Yeah.
Yeah, so he just sort of tinkered around with it. And
Yeah, he did. But like, I mean, he could play anything. It was amazing. And I went and I had piano lessons and everything and I kind of got okay at playing the piano, but I never could play by ear the way he could.
And what kind of music was he sort of influenced by, or sort of, because we're so influenced by our parents' choice of music when we're very young.
Yeah, well, when he played the piano, he used to kind of play a lot of traditional Irish songs and stuff like that. But music that he enjoyed listening to was big band music and jazz music and all of that. I suppose which was kind of popular when he was growing up as well. You know, that would have been the music he would have gone out and socialised to and everything. And so he was real into his tech, you know. And so we're talking
music
about
tech at that stage.
Music tech at that stage. So I do you know, one of the great regrets I have for him is that he never lived long enough to
see what we have now.
You know, he would have been an early adopter of everything. But he used to record his albums onto an open tape disc and then just play them, so he'd have 3 or 4 hours of music. And of course, whenever he was doing that, he would have to do it. We'd have to be quiet. Nobody could move.
Because you couldn't get the audio wrong. You couldn't have a door slam. Yeah, you couldn't have done anything.
Exactly.
And one of the memories that you have of your dad is of what kind of one of those big, big epic tunes. We'll have a little listen to it now. But what was it about Glenn Miller's In the Mood?
Well, it was one of those ones that, you know, it just has that real get up and go about it. And what would happen was, I think it was one of the first ones he'd put on when he was playing his tape deck.
Yeah.
And as soon as it came on, I would run into the room and we'd just start dancing and we'd be jiving around and he'd be dancing with me. And it was just one of those really joyous times of childhood, you know. And my mum would come in too, and she was a good dancer. And so they would sometimes dance and I'd be in between them dancing. And it was, you know, it's one of those real kind of cliche things about childhood, if you like, you know.
And an early formative memory. Let's have a quick listen. This is Glenn Miller's In the Mood. And if you could see us now, the pair of us shoulder dancing away, I can just imagine it really, really brings you back. Your house, you know, your home must have been quite a creative, in its own way, a creative place. Was your mum creative as well?
My mum loved writing herself, although she didn't actually write that much, but she loved reading and writing. My dad loved reading and writing. But we were
a big books house.
We were, but we weren't a house with a lot of money. So we didn't have a lot of books, although the books that we have were treated reverently. Do you know what I mean? So, but Like I was really lucky because they, both my parents encouraged reading so much, and we were never really told, I mean, occasionally, but not often told, to get your nose out of that book and go outside and do something.
And what was the young you reading? Like what do you remember as the books of your childhood?
Do you know, I read everything. I read all the things that were common back in the day of, you know, like, you know, those early things like What Katie Did and Little Women and all of those books. And then I kind of read Enid Blyton books and I read Eleanor Brent Dyer, all those school stories. So anything.
Which were brilliant.
Yeah, they were, and there were such great characters in them. That was the thing, and I think that was what I loved, was loads and loads of different characters, all with different issues, all behaving differently. But I know my dad used to have copies of P.G. Wodehouse, which he loved, and I read those, and I had no clue what they were going on, but I knew that the English was fantastic, so I enjoyed reading
them. Do you have a memory where you even, when you look back in your childhood, where you think that ultimately, where you became a writer, was that rooted in your childhood? Like, I mean, were you really engaged in stories as a child?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, I was lucky. My mum used to read to me every day before I could read myself. And I don't know, I think I might have said this to you personally before one time when we were chatting. But I remember one time when she had finished the book and I said to her, yes, but what happens next? And she said to me, well, you tell me. And so I did. And kind of that was the start of it, was suddenly, oh, these characters somebody else has written about, I can make up things about them too. And so for quite some time, I used to write little short things about books that I'd read, and I'd write an epilogue myself. And then suddenly you're thinking, well, I mean, I'm going to make up my own characters. You know, so that was from really, really young.
Yeah, and you'd entertain like your siblings with your sort of Well,
I did. I did. I used to write these school stories because, like, I'm in Walkinstown in the 60s, 70s. There was no boarding school. Yeah. There was no midnight feast. There was none of that. But I created this school that was in a cliff, on the top of a cliff top, and all these populated with cast of characters. And I would write chapters and say to my sister, particularly, you know, if you do my chores, I'll write another chapter.
So that commercial edge was
just
very,
there,
it was
there.
It was just,
no messing with me.
From the beginning. I know Enid Blyton, the amount of us who wanted to go to boarding school as a result of those books was just brilliant. The your dad sadly passed away when you were quite young, and sometimes it's those moments in life that it can be. We were speaking earlier to David Gillick about, you know, defining moments in life, but that changed probably the own course of your own life in terms of, you didn't start out life as a writer.
No, I didn't. I mean, sadly, my dad became ill when I was in my early teens, and in my late teens, he passed away. And, you know, it does change your outlook on life in a lot of ways. I think it shook a lot of certainties that I had because, you know, as I was saying, look, we used to dance and we used to have great fun. And I kind of always believed that my parents would be there. And when my dad was ill, it was a really difficult time for all of us because we owned a shop, and so my mum was trying to keep the shop going. And so, you know, even though when I was at school and when I was growing up, everybody said, oh, she'll do something in books, you know, she will. Even if it was just work in a bookshop or work in a library was actually what I thought. But, you know, there was really, as soon as my dad passed away, like the imperative of me, I felt, was to get a job go out, and because there was no other income coming in. And again, the support.
But that must be very a lot of pressure for your mum when your dad was ill. He's a young teenager. She's trying to keep, you know, the home fires burning.
Absolutely. And, you know, the support, like, I know that not everybody has the support that they need now, but the support then was even less. And I do remember her trying to get, I can't remember what support it was, but some guy coming around to the house and telling her, well, if she was that badly off, she could sell her telly. And, you know,
the assumptions that are made. Well, what was the music in your life at, you know, that time? Like, I mean, American pop would have been very kind of cool and huge at that point, but you took a bit of a different tack.
Well, at that time, the poster that I had on my wall was Gilbert O'Sullivan, and it was Gilbert O'Sullivan in his very early incarnation, you know, where he had the flat cap and he was wearing kind of...
You were a big fan.
I was a huge fan. And the reason I was a fan was, one, that the melodies were quite complex, which I liked, and also that the lyrics were very meaningful, which I also liked. And whilst, you know, I don't mind a pop song and all that sort of stuff, but, you know, the kind of Donny Osmond, David Cassidy, I love you, boop, boop, boop sort of stuff just did nothing for
me. But you did what many teenage girls do, and you wrote to your hero. Oh,
I did, and I enclosed with him an entire set of lyrics for one of his albums that I had rewritten for him. I had just repurposed every song and written my own set of lyrics for them. And he wrote back, which was really nice.
What did he say?
He actually invited me along to, he was doing, I don't know whether it was an appearance on RTE or something. Yes, it was. And he invited me along to be in the audience, and he wanted me to sing one of the songs with him. But, like, I have no voice, Dervla, and that was a step too far.
He is the choice of your second song. It was Why Have You Chosen Nothing Rhymed?
Well, because one of the things in this, as I said, the lyrics are really important to me. And there is a great line in this song which says, that, you know, the right to be wrong if I choose. And I believe that we have to make our own mistakes. And I remember shouting that at my mother once. And you know the way your parents are always trying to... And I said, no, if it's wrong, it's wrong. But it's me. It's my right.
I have the right to be wrong. And Gilbert O'Sullivan, who's on my wall, said it. Let's have a quick listen to Nothing Rhymed.
This feeling inside me could never deny me the right to be wrong if I choose. This pleasure I get from, say, winning a bet is to lose. Nothing good, nothing bad, nothing ventured, nothing gained, nothing still born or lost, nothing further than proof, nothing wilder than you, nothing older than time, nothing sweeter than wine, nothing physically reckless. Nothing I couldn't say, nothing why I cost today, nothing rhymed.
And already, Sheila, your choice of music selections are bringing back memories for lots of people.
Oh, really?
who are listening, getting in the mood, and said it's bringing back memories of their own Sunday afternoons. Your path from the world of finance to the world of fiction is well trodden. We know and understand it quite well. Do you think that it prepared you well for life as a writer, you know, being in quite a male-dominated area, in, you know, and an area that we mightn't associate with creativity, but in fact does involve a lot of it?
Yeah, well, I always say being in finance, you do have to be extremely creative sometimes and not necessarily always in the best
but not
way.
Too creative. Just too creative. Don't run crazy, Jenna, because sometimes being too creative gets you in a little bit of trouble.
I think it, well, what it did, what it does is it knocks the edge off you. You know what I mean? I think creative people, you know, you have a vision. You have a feeling of how you want whatever work it is, whether it's art or music or writing, and you have a vision of what you want it to be and how you want it to be seen and how, all of those things. But the vision that you have whilst in the creating of it, you know, you can dig deep into yourself and you get that perfectly. In the bringing it to the wider world is not always the way you want it to be done, you know. And I think when you have already gone through a career in something like finance, where nothing is ever the way you want it to be necessarily, I think you understand the economic side of it more, and you understand that, you know, from my point of view, for me, the most important thing is creating the book, creating the characters, bringing the story to life.
But once you do, you lose control over it.
Exactly.
It passes over.
When it goes into the bookshops, the bookseller has a completely different kind of view of how they want this book to be and how they want to sell it.
Let's talk with me as well about the reality of, you know, the world of selling books. Like, I mean, your productivity is off the scale. You haven't stopped since you started. And yet there is this sort of the economics of the literary world and the snobbery still. Like, I mean, you're on the bestseller lists all the time, but this kind of snobbery between literary fiction, and I'm doing some air quotes here, and, you know, and kind of what sometimes is dismissed as sort of women's fiction, or, you know, and even, you know, the late Maeve Binchy would have, you know, even spoken to this as well.
Yeah, yeah. I had a few chats with her about it, and she often said, you know, if they praised my books as much as they praised me, you know, for writing them, you know, if they got that kind of literary acclaim, it would be fantastic. But then she said, I have the sales.
Yeah.
You know, but there is a kind of a thing.
Is it that thing, you know, the Colm Tveen versus the Colleen Tveen, you know, that sort
of,
you know, and, you know, do we perceive women writers differently?
Do you know, I wonder, first of all, I think we do, but I kind of think maybe that is just a more generic thing as well, where no matter what a woman does, it's always looked at from some kind of male perspective of it's never as important. It's never, you know, that thing where in a meeting you say something five times and then a guy says it and they say, oh,
it's the Great New Yorker cartoon. I think, you know,
yes, I'm waiting for the
or the other thing, and I think I've been guilty of this once or twice myself, you know, where you might ask a female author, you know, is it biographical or is it based on, you know, maybe questions that we wouldn't ask a male author.
Yeah, I think there is an element of that. So I think outside of, you know, the literary fiction and the commercial fiction or women's fiction scenario, there is just that, you know, perspective, that male perspective that comes over everything. Having said that, I also think that, you know, the books that I write and the book many women write that deal with, you know, very personal things and domestic things and, you know, that's seen as not as important as some great worldview on something. But everybody's worldview is formed by what has happened in the home domestically. And so to me, there is nothing more important in life than the relationships that people have with each other and with their families and with people around them.
And the figures speak for themselves because there is so much demand.
There is, but I also like, you know, in my books, I like to make them uplifting, that my characters do go through certain traumas during the course of the books, but I like to have an ending in which there is some kind of hope. And that, of course, means a lot of time that it's never going to be literary, because in the literary ones you have to be just going, oh my God, and it's even more despairing at the end.
Are readers, because readers get very attached to the writers and the characters, are they ever shy about coming forward and telling you what they think of your books?
Not at all shy of coming forward. I'm lucky because I have a lot of fantastic readers who are always, you know, really nice. And what I like actually is when people come along though and say, I went through something similar to the character in your last book, and that has helped me. You know, they have got better and I will get better. And, you know, some of the ones that I've written, you know, where people have lost somebody in their life, and, you know, I write about grief a bit. And so those things where people come back and say, this has helped me, I find that just really empowering, and it's a privilege when somebody says that to you, you know.
Can I ask you about writing about grief and experiencing it? Because you're on a writing break at the moment because of the loss of both your mum and your sister in the last year. How has that been for you?
I think the reason that I said that I wanted to take a break was that I, you know, I write very emotionally. You know, I use a lot of emotion when I write. And I was dealing with my own personal emotions, and I just didn't feel that that was something that I was ready to harness or be able to put to one side and deal with somebody else's trauma, you know. And it was traumatic. My mum was quite elderly, and so you know, she had come to end of life, and that's just the way it was. But it, you know, at the same time, even though you know that something is going to happen, that doesn't make it any easier. And the last couple of months of her life were difficult. She was struggling with her health, and so that was hard, you know, that was hard to deal with. And very sadly, my sister, who had lived with breast cancer for a long time, you know, just finally was not able to continue herself. You know, she had also come to end of life with that illness. And she was my younger sister. So it's really difficult to lose somebody who you have known all of your life, you know. And so, you know, you do have to kind of sit back and process those things. And that was why I said I was just going to give myself time to process it and just do some different things. And you know, it has been helpful. Every so often I scribble down some notes for myself. But I just felt the thing to do was just to step back for a while.
Yeah, so, so difficult. And I know that you will obviously return to the page. The inner, what you've just even articulated, does really reflect a lot of the inner dialogue and the inner experience of a lot of your characters, which, as I say, we as readers become attached to. But your third choice of a song, I have to admit, which is a big, big motivation for you, is one that I have never heard of. It's called I'm Not a Freak. Can you maybe just give us a bit of an insight into this track?
Well, this was a song that I actually heard when we went on holidays to the Caribbean one year, that's quite a number of years ago now. And it had been a really difficult year and we hadn't been away. And, you know, I can't remember everything that had gone on that year.
Just
but you
wasn't
know the
a
way
good
you have
year.
One of those years that Anna's everything horrible. Just seems to go wrong. Anyway, we said, no, we're going to go away. Beginning of December, off we went to the Caribbean. And we walked into the hotel, this song was playing. And it just inspired me. It was just amazing. The lyrics were amazing. It's coming from a completely different place for me because it's a song of faith and I am not a religious person. I don't have that kind of faith, but the singer in this song, Etana, does. And so she is using her faith. But, you know, it was one of these songs that it was no matter what life throws at you, I'm not afraid. I'll carry on. And it just was really meaningful for me at that time.
Well, it's probably going to be very new for a lot of our listeners as well. This is Etana and I'm Not Afraid.
But protected by the Most High One. They don't mind when you fall behind and can't pay your bills on time. Prostituting and standing in a them government line. No, and they don't mind when you waste your time coming up with some stupid lines, influencing the youth them for snatch a line and take a life. And they don't mind when you locked up in jail.
There we go. It's actually, once you listen to it, it's a great track. Sheila, I wouldn't normally comment on another woman's appearance except to say that you are sporting the best grey hair, don't care, post-pandemic. The last time I saw you, this was not your haircut and it really, really suits you. It's fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you.
Did you make that strategic choice that many of us are going to have to make soon? What was it that made you decide, I'm not dying it any longer?
Do you know, it was after the flipping pandemic. I should have done it during the pandemic when we were all feral and nobody would have even noticed. But yeah, it was just, I had, like during the pandemic, I was ordering all this stuff online and making sure I was, and then suddenly it was like, I went back to the hairdresser and she was doing all the stuff and I went, oh my God, I can't do this faff anymore. And I just said, I'll let it grow out. I'll see what it's like. And we just went a little bit blonde first and I am not blonde. Do you know, that's not my colour. And I said, no. We're just,
this is it.
This is it.
Yeah. And it looks,
this is it.
It's brilliant because, like, increasingly, and maybe this is your own evolution as a writer, but you've always written about older women, but you are writing about them more. And that experience, you know, like, I'm presuming that the remarks unearthed by people such as J.D. Vance and the...
Oh, my God.
She's shaking her head, listener.
Oh
she's
God,
shaking. Her hands have gone to her head. It's the, you know, but that notion of how we treat women and whether they are child free or not, or whether they're postmenopausal or not, whatever it is. And I kind of feel as if you're coming out now to really defend the older woman now.
Yes, I am the postmenopausal, you know, I have gone through the rage. No more F's to give, you know, that entire thing. That is me now.
But it's because often the way that others depict particularly sometimes when male writers trying to capture that. But I really just felt that you're really, really drawing on this, you know, whether it's women in their 60s or 70s, you're just breaking them out of those stereotypes.
Well, I mean, I did write a piece a while back about the way women, older women, are portrayed in literature, and they are always portrayed as either like the wise grandmother, you know, dispensing, you know, her wisdom and her herbal remedies to all and sundry, or else somebody who's absolutely incapable of doing anything, you know, can't use her phone or something. And they just seem to be always treading those two lines with women. And I'm going, I tweeted about it. I would thread about it now, but yeah. And I got loads of pictures from women in their 60s saying, this is me on my motorbike, this is me doing this. And I realised that actually part of the problem is that a lot of writers, you know, are writing about women in their 60s, but the writers are actually in their 30s or their 40s. And they're writing what they think you should be like rather than what you are actually like, or a vision of what they expect. And so I kind of feel when I'm writing an older person in my books, I want them to be a fully rounded person with their own life. And their life is not just looking after their grandchildren, as JD would have us do.
Oh, he would have us do that, but then obviously that reference sort of, and I know it's infuriated so many people, but to the childless kind of cat ladies, like as we're talking about, you know, fertility rates and birth rates dropping in, you know, lots of developed economies, but that, even the language around that, and that is something, again, I think that you are just
absolutely
back against.
But again, that kind of coming back to what I was saying before about things that women do being looked at, you know, from a male perspective, or but a particularly judgy, desperate male. You know, in this case, I mean, I know lots of lovely men who are not looking at women like that. But it is still embedded, really, though, in a consciousness. Oh, woman, fertile, not fertile,
children,
useless, not
children.
Useless. You know what I mean? That's the whole thing, yeah.
As if our whole function is developed that. Just to let you know that John and Taryn Ure says, Sheila, I'm male, 56, and I have decided not to dye my hair black anymore. It's decided to be totally natural and let it all hang out. It suits me better than I thought it would. I want to go from hair dyes to a place that is very special for you, and that is Spain. Mm. You have this enduring love affair with Spain. Where did that kind of start, and why is it that you're so drawn to that country?
It's just the culture. I mean, I remember when we were younger once, because we were all these brown-eyed people in a lot of blue-eyed people around us, you know, and somebody said to me, oh, one of your ancestors came over with the Armada. And so I had to figure out what that was and everything. And now there's a part of me that said, maybe they did.
Maybe they did. But it seems to be like a visceral thing to you, your love of it.
I do love it. Yeah, there is just something about the rhythm of the country and the rhythm of the life there and the people that it just connects with me on some kind of level. And I love the fact that they have managed to have a Moorish past and a Catholic culture, and obviously that was entirely traumatic, you know, 500 years ago. But now, though, both of those cultures are celebrated. Like every summer in our local town, there's a Moors and Christians festival, and people dress up, and the costumes are amazing. And they embrace the culture, they embrace family, and they embrace eating out, which is obviously something
and
I enjoy doing.
Of course, their music is so
and
rich.
The music is just amazing.
And all of those big influences. I love your next pick for your choice of music. Let's listen to this, the Adagio from the Concerto de Aranque. Beautiful Aranque guitar concerto. That was the fourth choice of my guest, Sheila O'Flanagan, who is with me. Sheila, you're on a writing break, so but you're scribbling, so we can expect a little bit more. What are you going to do with this time that you've afforded to yourself?
Well, I am doing a little bit more travel, and I have been doing a little bit of travel around Spain. But one of my things that I enjoy doing is going to tennis tournaments. I'm kind of a little bit sporty from time to time. And so
tennis has been a big part of your life, has it?
Well, watching tennis. I play badminton, but I watch tennis. And so my husband and I have picked selected tournaments, and we are going to the tournaments. I have gone to some. We went to Mallorca earlier in the year. We went to Madrid. We're going to another tournament later on in November. And so I'm kind of doing those things where before you wouldn't have time to do them, or you'd say, I can only do one of those things and I have other things to do. And now we're kind of saying, no, we'll do a year of tramping around to stuff like that, and just basically chilling out. That's what I'm trying to do. Yeah.
Taking a little break to one Sheila from another Sheila. One of our listeners who's called Sheila said, I bought Sheila's first book in 1997 when I heard it about her from her Aunt Angela.
Oh my
goodness. Your Aunt Angela was sharing a room with her late mother in St. James's Hospital. She says, Angela was an absolute lady. And this Sheila says, I was a librarian for many years and Sheila's books were so popular. Another devoted fan, Mary, says, my introduction to Sheila was reading her plain English articles in the business section of the Irish Times while she worked in the central bank. Mary says, luckily for this devoted fan, she went into writing full time. But many people will be hoping that when you, after this little break, that you will obviously return to the page. Before I let you go, you have a final choice of music, and it's Joni Mitchell's Both Sides Now. Why have you chosen that?
Well, I kind of feel it's a little bit of a kind of full circle in a way about, you know, life generally and how you approach life when you were younger and how you approach life when you're older. How we look at things from one perspective and how we look at them from another. Joni Mitchell, again, for me, her lyrics are amazing. All of her work is fantastic. And I know a lot of people have covered her songs, but I love when she sings her own songs. I think Both Sides Now, which she wrote in her 20s, is just such a clever, clever
song. Well, let's
have
a listen.
Tears and fears and feeling proud to say I love you right out loud. Dreams and schemes and circus crowds, I've looked at life that way. But now old friends are acting strange. They shake their heads. They say I've changed. Well, something's lost, but something's gained in living every day. I've looked at life from both sides now, then win and lose, and still somehow life's illusions. I recall, I really don't know life
at all. Joni Mitchell's Both Sides Now. Well, author Sheila Fang, thank you so much for sharing some of your life reflections through the lens of your music choices. We really have enjoyed chatting to you today. So best of luck, and we're going to take a quick app break.